First, the work to build a coalition to help the U.S. fight ISIS continues today. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Turkey, where there are fears about joining the coalition because Sunni militants hold more than 40 Turkish hostages. French President François Hollande is in Iraq. France may contribute to the airstrikes that so far have been carried out only by U.S. planes. President Obama says the goal of military action is to destroy ISIS, which has taken over large parts of Syria and northern Iraq in recent months. But White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice told NPR today that the U.S. cannot do this alone.
Unless they're willing to fight for their own country and maintain and control territory effectively, there's nothing any outsider can do that will be effective on a sustained basis.
Greg Jaffe is a reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us from Erbil. And Greg, how are people there reacting to the president's speech?
Well, certainly here in Kurdistan, it's really popular. I mean, I was talking with the deputy prime minister here yesterday, and the word he wanted to hear was destroy. He wanted to hear destroy, and he wanted to hear that there were going to be airstrikes in Syria. I think the Kurds have felt like that they were sort of up here on their own for a long time. And so, to be honest, I think they were very happy about the speech.
You mentioned, Greg, that Kurds may be pleased about this largely, but obviously really complicated geopolitics over there. What about sentiment from other countries in the region that may not be as pleased as the Kurds?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, the Turks, I think, kind of go back and forth on it, and they've had a sort of hot and cold relationship with the Kurds that in some ways has warmed up in recent years. The tension that you see the most right now is just between the various militia forces that are out there. There's really very little Iraqi army presence. So the tension that's most palpable here on the ground is between some of the Shia militias and the Kurds, which come together to fight for territory. And then as soon as they've won it, kind of fight with each other over who should be in charge of it.
The CIA says now that there may be as many as 30,000 ISIS fighters. How many are fighting there around Erbil?
You know, it's a very sort of disorganized fight. Even the Peshmerga, which we think of as this vaunted force, I mean, a lot of them drive to the front in their cars, hop out, and they drive back for a few hours. Some of them, because of the shortage of weapons, were buying their weapons at the bazaar. So it's hard to estimate, I think. I'd be guessing, I think.
The BBC's Jim Muir reports that some aircraft may use an airbase in Erbil to take off from some of these strikes. Do you know anything about that? And is the assumption that this refers to U.S. aircraft?
Yeah, I think the Post reported, if I'm not mistaken, that they were going to try and fly some drone Predator drones or possibly Reaper drones out of that airbase. And, you know, that's also been the kind of the hub for where some of the weapons are coming in from NATO nations in the U.S. to try and help give the Kurds, the Peshmerga forces, a little bit more firepower.
Greg, how close is the fighting to Erbil right now?
Within 25 to 30 miles. It's funny, though, at this moment. I mean, life seems very kind of normal here at times. There was certainly a scary moment in August when it looked like the Pesh were folding and the Islamic State fighters were surging towards here. You know, a lot of people fled. A lot of airlines canceled flights and there was a bit of a panic. But it's amazing how quickly, at least within Erbil, things have gotten back to normal. That said, you can hop in a car and you could be at the front lines in, you know, in 20 minutes.
Really?
Well, a little bit longer, but yeah, 30 minutes or 20, 25 miles away, yeah.
Greg, we've mentioned that ISIS has taken over large parts of Syria and northern Iraq, but give us a sense of how its presence is felt, you know, maybe not just in terms of military presence, but in terms of sort of running those areas, sort of governing them.
I think the first couple of days, Sunnis were kind of happy and they viewed them as liberators. And then I think they were witness to some pretty terrific brutality. And you can see it not too far away. I was outside the town of Amerli, which is, you know, about an hour's drive from here a couple of days ago. That was the city that was surrounded by ISIS and recently liberated. And the locals were exhuming bodies, which were just lying along the side of the road. And it was really heartbreaking to see many of them had just been shot and abandoned there in June. And so the smell of death was all over that city, and it was a sobering moment.
We've been talking about how much you feel ISIS presence. What about U.S. presence? According to the Pentagon, there are more than 1,000 U.S. military members on the ground in Iraq. Is that a visible presence? Can you feel it and see it?
No, not at all. You know, you can move around Erbil very, very easily, but you don't see them at all. And, you know, Kurds have said that some of the new weapons coming in are going to a new battalion that they're standing up that's getting training from some of these American trainers, but you don't see them at all. And they've kept the press far away from those folks.
Greg, I believe you were with the last U.S. combat troops when they pulled out of Iraq in December 2011. Is that right?
I was, yeah.
So what does it feel like to be back there 3 years later?
You know, that was such a surreal night as they were pulling out. It was almost like a little bit of a carnival. You know, people were barbecuing before we left. It was unlike any other convoy that I'd ever been on.
A carnival in terms of a celebratory sense?
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, people were barbecuing hot dogs and hamburgers. You know, I think we left around 2 a.m. and drove through the night down these just deserted roads without a single car, deserted highway through the desert, rolled through this gate, and they closed it. And that was the end of the war. And it was just almost, you know, it was hard to imagine that that's how it ended.
But now you're back and some of the military's back.
Yeah. No, and the strange thing is to see the fighting out there. And, you know, you're so used to seeing U.S. military patrols wherever you go if you covered Iraq, you know, during the height of the war. You know, it was our war. And increasingly, you know, the U.S. military is the hum of a drone overhead or a fighter jet. It's not something you see.
Greg Jaffe is a reporter for The Washington Post. He's been speaking to us from Erbil. Greg, thank you.
Sure, no problem.
Well, one of the countries that many lawmakers have been looking at as they assess whether to support airstrikes in Syria is Libya. 3 years ago, the U.S. led an international effort of airstrikes to support rebels on the ground in their quest to topple the longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. They were successful, but the country has since descended into chaos. Still, you don't hear many Libyans longing for the days of Gaddafi, who was known for his role in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland, which killed all 270 people on board, as well as his brutal treatment of Libyans. That world was brought to light in the book Gaddafi's Harem, the story of a young woman and the abuses of power in Libya. It's out in paperback this week. We spoke last year with author Annick Cojean, who initially went to Libya to report on Gaddafi's demise for the French newspaper Le Monde. She was particularly interested in the role of women in the revolution there. And a note, this conversation may not be appropriate for younger listeners.
I wanted to know what the woman had done during the revolution. You know, they were hidden. You couldn't see any report, any photograph, any documentary about the role of women in the revolution. And I wanted to know if they were hiding themselves, if people didn't want to show them, if they were supporting Gaddafi or on the contrary against him. But there was a big secret about women, and my colleagues, mostly men colleagues, didn't write a word about women. So I came there for that first reason. And very, very quickly, I realized that they had played a major role during the revolution. They had provided combatants with food, hiding, transportation, health care, lots of information. They had bought arms, appropriated medical supplies, provided intelligence on the pro-Gaddafi forces. And they had really run incredible risk, especially the risk of been locked up and raped, given the fact that the Libyan dictator had turned rape into a weapon of war. And that stunned me. It was just unbelievable. And of course, these women didn't talk about that. That was a completely taboo subject.
Well, tell us about what you found that happened even before the revolution, because that is really the subject of your book. And let's start with Soraya. She was just a teenager. She was told that Gaddafi would be visiting her school and she was going to be able to present him with some flowers. And when he came in, he tapped her on the head. Tell us what happened next.
Oh, well, you know, she was so surprised. She was so excited, like all the girls of the school, because the dictator was coming, the guide of the revolution. They all were calling him Papa Gaddafi. And when he came, he just had a look on her. She was trembling, shaking, because she didn't know if she had to kiss his hand or do something, say a special word or something. But she just gave him the flowers. And he placed his hand, on his prey's head in what was supposed to be an affectionate gesture, I guess. And this would be a signal to his bodyguards. That meant, I want this one. And the next day, three women came to her home and took her, obliged her mother to give her, while saying, you know, a stupid pretext, that thing, oh, she's been so good with Gaddafi yesterday that it would be good if she could offer him another bouquet, which was just stupid. And so they took her, put her in a car, and they drove to the desert. And then she was prepared, washed, shaven.
Given a blood test.
Yes, always. All the women who were supposed to be close to Gaddafi were always having a blood test. Even, you know, even in very important people, even professors, even deputies, members of the parliament, or it could be even wives of head of states. Everybody was supposed to have a blood test. And of course, she had that. And then she was pushed in his bedroom, and he tried to rape her. It took some time, and because she fought and she wasn't prepared, she was just a kid. She knew nothing about love, nothing about sex. This is you have to know, it's a very, very conservative country, and it was just impossible to imagine this kind of thing. And well, in fact, he detained her for 5 years. She was put in his basement, and she was forced very quickly, against her will, of course, to drink, to smoke, to take cocaine. She was put into a kind of harem, which was constantly being added to, and which was, yes, located in his basement, and could call her at any time of the day and night, and with very many other women who were coming from all parts of the countries and from different countries.
And not just women, there were men as well.
Yeah. But that's even more taboo. Even the Libyans don't want to admit this idea right now. But yes, there were a lot of young men also.
Anik Kojan, the author of Gaddafi's Harem, The Story of a Young Woman and the Abuses of Power in Libya. It's out this week in paperback. And again, this conversation may not be appropriate for younger listeners. The book focuses on one girl in particular, Soraya, who was taken into Gaddafi's harem after he met her at her school when she was just a teenager. In the book, Kojan writes in Soraya's voice about the day she was in the school, quote, "My heart was beating 100 miles a minute while everyone worked hard to make us look magnificent. As I look back to that scene today, I see it as preparing lambs to be led to slaughter."
Exactly. And, you know, I was very lucky because I met just by chance this young woman. And, you know, it is just unbelievable that she accepted to talk. And I'm lucky because she has a very good memory. She can describe with lots of details the scenes. And she was very brave because lots of women had exactly the same story. And you can't find other testimonies like Soraya's now in Libya. They are so ashamed. They are risking. She's risking her life.
Even if you are the victim of rape, you are seen as having sex outside of marriage.
It is terrible. And, you know, crimes of honor exist still a lot in Libya. I've met two different young women, young girls, I should say. She was 16. They had been raped. And they have been killed for having been raped. But she wanted to talk. And that was the reason why I wrote this story, because it concerns probably thousands of young women who have been raped by Gaddafi. Sometimes he could take them for 1 hour, for a night, for a week, for a month, or for years. In Soraya's case, it was for 5 years.
Well, one of the interesting things is that she actually does get out at one point. Her father sneaks her out of Libya. She gets to Paris. And because she has lived in this insane world in Libya under Gaddafi, she has no idea what to do. And she ends up coming back.
Oh, it is terrible. It's desperating. And, oh, yes, well, she was so ashamed of herself because she finally, yes, came back to Libya and she was free, and she should have been more capable to stay in France. But she didn't speak the language. And, you know, this kind of woman have a very low self-esteem, and she was a body, and she had the feeling everybody was interested into her body. So her relationship with men was just terrible. Everybody was taking profit of her, etc. So it was just a disaster when she was in Paris. And since then, I wish she could come to Paris again, but she has very awful memory. You know, she doesn't know how to make a living. She didn't know, she has no discipline. She was just escaping from the harem and had no relation, no idea what could be relationship between men and women. So yes, her escape in Paris has been a disaster. And then she came back. And the minute she put a foot in Libya again, coming from the airport, immediately Gaddafi's people found her. And a couple of hours later, she was back in his basement.
One of the images that many Americans have of Gaddafi is him standing there with these female guards, these Amazons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it appears from your reporting that they were not guards at all.
No, most of them were not. Well, some had a small training at the Women's Military Academy or at the Police Academy, but they were chosen to be in this special elite, just for their looks and because he was attracted by all these kind of women. And even Soraya, who is, you know, she was 15 when she was taken by Gaddafi, and when every time she was accompanying him in his various homes, she was obliged to wear the uniform of this unit and would have to pretend to be a battle-hardened soldier. Only a handful of these women, yes, had undergone some training. Most of them knew just nothing. They didn't know how to fight. They had no idea at all. It was just a total sham.
Why do you think, Annick Cojon, that nobody wants to talk about this, even now, after Gaddafi is out and dead?
Yeah.
You have gone back in and tried to get people to tell you all about this. Many of them, it is clear from your interviews, knew what was going on, but they don't want to talk about it.
Oh, no. In this society governed by religion and tradition, sex is a totally taboo subject, as I was saying. Victims and eyewitnesses were still so afraid to talk about this topic, and several of the people that I spoke with received threats and intimidation. Very often I was told, it would be best for you, boss, you and Libya, if you were to abandon this investigation. And at the very highest levels of government, the investigation was viewed as an affront, an insult. You know, as a rape of a young girl brings dishonor upon her entire family, especially upon the male members of the family, the rape of thousands of women by the country's former ruler inevitably brings dishonor upon the entire country. This society can't bear this kind of secret.
Are you optimistic about the future of women in Libya?
Oh, I don't know what to say. My temperament normally is I'm optimistic, but this is so complicated, really. You know, I had a big surprise also to see that there was twice a demonstration with posters with the cover of my book in French and in Arabic, because it has been translated in Arabic. And some women were in the street and saying, never again, please, never again. So, you know, there's a little bit of debates now about that. Also, there was some election. There have been, I was going to say quite, but they have been democratic in a way. And there was rather good surprise. And 30 women have been elected at the parliament also. So some of them mention and are very aware of the situation and are trying to protect and to defend women. So at least they don't have this fear of the dictator, because he was ready to, he was taking all occasion, weddings, school visits, university lectures, fashion shows, etc., to catch women. So this is finished, and it can't be worse. But still, it's still very, very complicated and very dangerous for women.
Well, it is an incredible book. Annick Cojon, the author of Gaddafi's Harem, the story of a young woman and the abuses of power in Libya. Annick Cojon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, you.
Well, since that interview last October, the situation in Libya has gotten worse. Islamist militias have captured the capital, Tripoli, and the parliament that Cojon tells us about is losing its grip on power. This week, The Guardian reported that 32 women are still sitting members of parliament in Libya, but overall, just over half of the 200 seats in parliament are filled. That's a result of boycotts, intimidation, and logistical problems. We've got an excerpt from the book, Annick Cojon's book, Gaddafi's harem at hearandnow.org.
The governor of Nevada signed a $1.25 billion tax deal last night that gives the electric car company Tesla a green light to open a lithium-ion battery factory in Reno. The tax break is 15 times larger than any deal in Nevada history, and it's being applauded by many who say it will greatly boost the state's economy. But some lawmakers are concerned it takes too much money away from education and the state's fledgling film industry. Chris Cerotti is a reporter for KNPR in Las Vegas, and he joins us to tell us more. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Chris, I understand that the Nevada legislature passed four bills to get this tax break through. So tell us about what this deal looks like.
Well, the deal basically looks like Tesla will get about $1.3 billion in tax credits and tax abatements, and they'll get a discount over several years on energy use. The legislature approved a measure that will enable Tesla to sell its electric cars directly to consumers instead of through a network of franchise dealerships. And it also takes money away from insurance company tax credit and film production tax credits to help pay for the deal. And it also excuses them from property taxes and payroll taxes for up to 10 years.
So pretty generous.
It's very generous.
In terms of the state's return on investment, we know, for example, that it's expected to bring more than 6,500 jobs to Nevada, and that obviously must make the state and businesses happy. But what else is in for it? What else in the state does the state get besides jobs?
Well, the governor, Brian Sandoval, has said that he expects this deal with Tesla to result in about $100 billion in revenue for Nevada over the next 20 years. But going forward now, it would create about 3,000 construction jobs as they move forward here in the next few months on building this factory.
And what do unions think about this?
Well, unions are a little cautious. The AFL-CIO of Nevada has been very, very steadfast in making sure that Tesla follows a specific rule in this massive package of incentives that says 50% of the workers must be Nevada residents. That's 50% of the 6,500 they hire once the factory opens and 50% of the 3,000 construction workers that will be building the plant.
Chris, we mentioned earlier that there is some opposition. There's some concern and fear that the state is sort of subsidizing this company too much with tax breaks. So tell us about those concerns.
The concerns really come from lobbying organizations who say, you know, this is great. We want to welcome them in. But they're really, really concerned that this is too generous of a package. You really haven't seen this with any other company here in Nevada. And so they're expressing concerns that it's going to affect education because we're not going to have enough tax revenue, even though Tesla has made a commitment to give about $35 million over 5 years to the Northern Nevada schools to mitigate any impact from more workers coming into the state. So they're concerned about schools. You mentioned a little bit about the film tax credit, which has people up in arms because they're taking a drastic amount of money, basically $70 million, and leaving the tax credit program with 10 moving forward. And people are concerned about that.
Do they think it's the end of the film industry in the state?
Well, the film industry here is so young that it really some people do, some people don't. But Democrats especially have said we're going to bring it back up in the legislative session that begins in February because it started at $80 million and now they've left $10
million. So a big decline.
Very big decline.
Chris Cerotti reports for KNPR in Las Vegas. Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
A new poll shows Republicans leading in 22 out of 35 governors' races around the country that are up for grabs in November. That advantage is in part because Republicans are incumbents in 20 states, and only one incumbent governor, Tom Corbett of Pennsylvania, is trailing. That is according to the poll from CBS News and The New York Times. Other Republican governors thought to be vulnerable include Michigan's Rick Snyder and Sam Brownback in Kansas, all hold at least a small lead in the poll, and will continue to follow those races in the coming weeks. But we want to turn now to this week's district profile. Each week, we're profiling a congressional race, and this week it is Florida's 26th district, where incumbent Democrat Joe Garcia is fighting to keep his job from opponent Carlos Curbelo, a Miami-Dade school board member. John O'Connor of WLRN, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network, joins us from Miami. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, let's talk about this district. And I ask people to describe the district at the beginning of these district profiles. In this case, it is by far one of the most beautiful districts in the country.
Absolutely. This is a district that covers the southwestern portion of Miami-Dade County. It's really the suburbs of Miami. It stretches down south into Monroe County, which is the Florida Keys, all the way to Key West.
Right.
So you really have one of the most beautiful districts in the country. The main sources of jobs here, it's a suburban district, as I said. So a lot of the folks work in Miami itself. The Keys relies on tourism, but when you're talking Kendall, which is one of the main suburbs of Miami, you know, it's pretty much the economy you'll find in any suburb around the country.
Okay, well, let's get to the candidates. And first to the incumbent, Congressman Joe Garcia, who was elected in 2012 and who plays on his bio and the fact that his Cuban grandmother fled the Castro regime. Let's listen.
My grandmother's courage to stand up to Castro and protect her family taught me to do what's right no matter what. So when Washington politicians threatened to cut Medicare, I worked with both parties and protected those benefits. It's disappointing Carlos Curbelo rubber stamps Rick Scott's Tea Party agenda. Curbelo supports ending the Medicare guarantee and backs Rick Scott's massive cuts to our schools. I'm Joe Garcia, and I approve this message because I support South Florida, not political agendas.
And by the way, he's talking about Rick Scott, the Republican governor of Florida. And we should say that the nonpartisan PolitiFact rated part of this ad false, saying that the statement that Curbelo supported ending the Medicare guarantee is not true. But how is Joe Garcia positioning himself in this race?
This race is kind of a continuation of what came before it. Joe Garcia challenged the former office holder, David Rivera. Rivera was kind of plagued by investigations into whether or not folks who were working for him had funded a straw candidate in the Democratic primary. And so in 2012, the district had changed a little bit. There were these questions about Rivera, and Garcia became the first Cuban-American Democrat elected to Congress from Miami-Dade County. Now, 2 years later, we're kind of having a similar thing in that both candidates are kind of going after the credibility of each other. Garcia has a former campaign manager who's being investigated for putting up a straw candidate in the primary of his opponent. And with Curbelo, you have a guy who's being questioned. His wife owns a communications firm. He helps run the communications firm. And so there's been questions about whether or not clients of that firm have gotten school district contracts. Hmm. And so you heard kind of a hard pivot there in the middle of that ad. He starts by talking about his grandmother, and then all of a sudden the music changes and it gets a little sinister. And you're going to see that in this race, that both of the candidates are kind of going to go after each other, trying to paint each other as the worst choice. And you know, this is a guy who you should have questions about.
Well, let's hear from the Republican Carlos Curbelo. He's a Miami-Dade school board member, as we said. And here he is in a recent ad where he's shown washing dishes with his daughter.
Papi, this won't come off.
Don't worry, I'll take care of it. It's not easy to clean up the mess when it's been sitting for too long. Like corrupt politicians, they get rich, we get forgotten. We need new leaders who will look out for Florida families, not themselves.
Republican businessman Carlos Curbelo. On the school board, he built a reputation for honesty and integrity.
I'm Carlos Curbelo, and I approve this message. Let's clean up the mess. We deserve better.
You know, it's funny to hear a politician say, let's clean up the mess, because I remember back in 2002 when Mitt Romney was running for governor, his whole slogan was, I'm going to clean up the mess.
Yeah, I mean, this is a common dynamic in Florida politics that a lot of these this district in particular, the split between Democratic and Republican voters is so close. It's a very, very much a swing district. And so, you know, if you really want to move the needle, one of the best ways to do it as a candidate is to go after your opponent. And we're definitely seeing it in this race.
Well, tell us a little bit about Carlos Curbelo.
Yeah, as he's served on the school board. He is a school board in Miami-Dade County. Miami-Dade is one of the biggest school districts in the country. So school board is a pretty nice perch to, you know, make a name for yourself locally, even sometimes nationally in terms of, you know, what the school district is doing. He is a Cuban-American. Again, he helps run his wife's communications firm. So there has been that question about whether or not clients of the firm have had business contacts with the school district.
What are the big issues for voters in this district?
From Garcia, you've heard them talking about Medicare, Medicaid, health care. He's also made an issue of flood insurance rates. With the federal flood maps changing, a lot of Florida residents have been hit with much higher flood insurance rates. And so that's an issue Garcia has been pushing. In most cases, this race has been a proxy for someone else. So you'll hear Garcia try and tie Curbelo to Rick Scott, the governor of Florida. You'll hear Curbelo try and tie Joe Garcia to President Barack Obama and his policies. And so that's really what the race is about. They're trying to make local and national issues kind of stick in this race.
And I know that redistricting has been an issue this summer in Florida.
Yes, not so much in this district. And this district is interesting because in the last round of redistricting, it went from a slightly more Republican district to a much more evenly split district. And that is one of the reasons why Joe Garcia won 2 years ago. So this district, it's rated basically a toss-up depending on which horse race service you're looking at on the ratings, maybe slightly favoring Republican voters. But it's very, very tight.
Are the national parties and national donors getting involved in this race?
Absolutely. You will see a lot of national money in this race once it gets fully up and running. Both the National Republican Committees and the National Democratic Committees are going to try and take this seat because, again, it's a close race and it is up for grabs and could go a long way in determining the balance of power in the House.
John O'Connor of WLRN in Miami, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network, talking with us about Florida's 26th district and the race for Congress there. John, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
There's a new movie out that sounds like dramatic Hollywood fiction. Two young boys determined to save a small country in Latin America. One is from that country. He's Ecuadorian, but educated in the United States. The other is from Massachusetts and is driven to action by a homework assignment in middle school. Both boys want to help Ecuadorian communities sickened by decades of oil drilling and oil spills. But this story is not fiction.
Going from these oil pits, these oil swamps, to passing oil stations, to seeing the roads lined with thick sludge, to seeing children walking along the roads without shoes, just sticks with you. These communities have been exploited, have been spit on, because underlying this whole issue is this racism that exists there.
The true story of the converging journeys of David Poritz of Amherst, Massachusetts, and Hugo Lusitante of Ecuador is told in a documentary called Oil and Water. It's a tale of crusaders, but of crusaders sometimes in conflict. Poritz and Lusitante are both committed to helping Ecuador's rainforest and its indigenous tribes, but at times they disagree about the best way to do that. David Poritz got involved in this issue when he was 11 years old.
The final sixth grade project was actually on different ecosystems of Latin America. And basically out of a hat, I was given the country of Ecuador.
That introduced Poritz to a world he's dedicated his life to ever since. When he learned about the long battle over oil pollution in the Ecuadorian rainforest, he became consumed.
I was so moved by the inherent contrast between the green Amazon jungle and the black oil that were found in the same location. It stuck with me, and I really got totally sucked in into this issue.
In his research, Poritz came across the name of a lawyer in his own hometown who was leading a lawsuit against Texaco over its drilling practices, Cristobal Bonifaz. And in the kind of coincidence that comes from living in a small community like Amherst, Poritz's English teacher was a woman named Margarita Bonifaz.
And I said, is your father Cristobal? Is your father Cristobal? I really want to meet this man because I was so moved by the work that he was doing and the dedication that he had clearly put towards this issue for so long. And after some nagging and after some more nagging, I finally got an introduction.
In that meeting, Poritz won over Cristobal Bonifaz and started volunteering for him on the case.
Really, every moment, every opportunity I had, I would go to this office, go to sort through these documents, and I had to show the connection and the linkages between the decisions that were made in the United States and the actions that took place in Ecuador.
Through his work on that lawsuit, Poritz ended up spending much of his high school years in Ecuador, nearly 3,000 miles from home. Meanwhile, an Ecuadorian teenager who shared Poritz's concerns about oil drilling was also intentionally displaced. 10-year-old Hugo Lusitante was living in Seattle. He'd been sent there by his tribe, the Kofan, which was reeling from decades of environmental disaster. Tribe elders saw leadership potential in Lusitante, so they wanted him to become familiar with Western culture in hopes that one day he could help the tribe take on the oil companies.
They wanted somebody who could speak both languages, who could really advocate for them. Initially, it was just to learn English, but he ended up staying 9 years learning the ways of what they thought was the enemy.
Laurel Spellman-Smith is one of the producers of the documentary Oil and Water. She followed Porritz and Lusitante with her camera over 8 years, beginning when they were teenagers.
They both were sent on this trajectory to save either their tribe or another part of the world, or really get involved in a bigger issue than themselves, and they were so young.
Porritz and Lusitante agreed to meet in Ecuador with the camera crew to talk about the devastation oil drilling had brought to Ecuador's tribal lands.
David actually was showing Hugo a lot of the damage that had happened, because Hugo hadn't actually seen a lot of the most devastated areas, because their tribe had actually moved down the river to escape the worst affected areas.
David Porritz and Hugo Lusitante became friends and colleagues, but they sometimes disagreed about the best way to help the Kofan tribe. Because despite his work on the Texaco lawsuit, Porritz began to doubt the value of that kind of litigation.
I realized that a different solution and a different mechanism was needed. Attacking oil companies and suing oil companies, although important in certain situations as the law is, was not the mechanism that I thought would bring real change to the sector.
Why didn't you think that would work?
It's not that I didn't think that it would work. It's not the path I wanted to take. I'd been part of this lawsuit for many years. I'd worked with a number of amazing individuals, but not any immediate benefit had been brought to the communities that the suit was trying to benefit. The reality needed to be addressed. You know, we as Americans, we as consumers, we as global citizens continue to use oil and gas. As that industry continues, and as we move away from the existence of oil and gas, hopefully, there still exists a need to dramatically improve the way it's produced.
So while David Porritz was studying at Brown University, he created a company, now called Equitable Origin, to try to change how oil is produced.
A critical tool in improving something is having the ability to measure it. You know, we measure students in school to evaluate school performance. Doctors measure us when we go to our physicals. Yet there wasn't that measurement tool for one of the largest industries in the world.
Porritz's company established a certification system to recognize companies that extract oil and gas in a responsible way. Basically, it gives a seal of approval to oil and gas products that meet certain standards for environmental and social impact. Porritz also tries to educate consumers to buy those sustainable ethical products. But Hugo Lusitante had a different point of view. He felt it was important to keep fighting the companies doing the drilling.
For as long as we can remember, they've been taking out oil. And that goes to cities, or we don't know where that money goes. And we should be the ones who are having the best education in the world, best resources, you know, but we're left with dump.
Hugo Lusitante wanted battle. David Porritz favored collaboration. But Porritz says both strategies are pieces of the same puzzle.
I think Hugo also came to appreciate the work that I was doing and the tactics that I was using. He began to see that, although different, it's part of a toolbox. They're not necessarily in opposition to one another. Many different means are needed to accomplish a goal.
But Porritz acknowledges that it's a difficult challenge to balance the competing interests of companies hoping to profit from natural resources and communities that live on top of resource-rich lands.
The moment that any stakeholder, industry or non-industry in this case, whether it be NGOs or academics, believes that we have weak standards or we are siding too much with one group or another, we lose all of our credibility. And it's that fine line that's so important.
Porritz and his company continue to walk that fine line. Just last month, Equitable Origin certified 2 oil fields for the first time, both in Colombia. Even so, oil spills still happen in Latin America, especially in Ecuador. But Porritz says his work has given indigenous communities a voice.
We're never going to fix the industry. We're not going to make the industry perfect. But we already have had a tremendous impact in a very positive way in giving agency to communities that have traditionally not had it and giving them the right to say, this is our vision for how oil development should look, and having companies agree with that.
That's David Poritz, the founder of Equitable Origin. Why he started the company is explained in the documentary Oil and Water, which will have its broadcast premiere on the PBS World Channel on September 21st. For more, go to hereandnow.org.
And Sasha, some sad news to tell you about in the music world. We're learning of the death yesterday of Bob Crewe, who co-wrote this hit and many others for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And Bob Crewe also co-wrote Lady Marmalade for Patti LaBelle and produced for Michael Jackson. Ah. He was 83 years old. Ah.